Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson. You know, with everything going on in Europe, it's time to refocus our attention and center on things going on there. To help us with that, today we have the good fortune of speaking again with Alistair MacLeod, publisher of financeandeconomics.org and a contributing editor at Peak Prosperity. And given his vantage point from Europe, I'm really keen on discussing his latest observations of where things are with the situation there. We've got the Italian elections. There's all sorts of things going on with Spain at this point in time. Portugal, France, you name it. It's a target-rich environment. Alistair, I'm really pleased to have you back as our guest.
It's very nice to be with you. Thank you.
I want to start right at the top. You know, I was looking at some reports recently that had come out from major brokerage firms. They were advising their clients that it's time to get back in the water, buy stocks. The crisis in Europe has been averted. Is that true?
No. In a word, no.
Great, we're done.
The way I would describe it, I think, Chris, is that the ECB did a very, very good job by stuffing the market with money, of keeping the show on the road, if I can put it that way. But you can only do that for so much for so long, and you know, the system is deteriorating quite rapidly underneath. Your readers would have will be aware of the Italian election, which you know, is no surprise. I mean, the thing about the Italian election is that the electorate was saying, no, we don't want this austerity. That's hardly a surprise, really. So no, the problem continues.
I was under the impression that we had a vehicle over there by which the ECB had promised that they were going to buy all the sovereign debt as long as the nations adhered to some of their rules, austerity being one of those rules. So Italy's borrowing cost dropped dramatically from the announcement of that vehicle. And indeed, Italian debt has been finding plenty of bidders, of course, courtesy of the ECB printing up and taking a lot of that through the OMT. As that vehicle, I believe, is called. And so now you have Italy saying, thanks so much for buying all our sovereign debt, and the people saying, and not so much on the austerity. Where does that leave us?
Well, I think you have to be aware of some basic numbers. Italy's debt to GDP is 126%. Now, their economy is not growing. They've had 2 years of recession, which basically means that GDP is dropping. We don't have a lot of inflation, so the deflator is not that great. Now, with interest rates tonight standing at about 4.75% for the 10-year bond, that implies that they have got to, in order to pay the interest, which accumulates, if you like, on top of debt, that the economy, the whole economy, has got to grow in excess of 4.5% to 5% in order for them to have a chance of paying that debt back or stabilize it. And that assumes that they have a balanced budget. And that's really the uphill struggle against which the Italians are fighting.
Well, Alistair, that 4.5% to 5% growth, is that nominal or real, understanding that if the deflators...
Yeah, I mean, it would have to be... I mean, really, we're talking about nominal because, you know, I mean, really, if you assume that the interest is just added to the overall debt, which is broadly what happens, then GDP has got to grow in order to match that. Consequently, you know, if it doesn't, the debt-to-GDP ratio rises. It's as simple as that. And thinking about it while I'm talking, it has to be real because that's the comparison that's made.
That is a comparison. Of course, if your deflator is almost zero, nominal and real are about the same.
It's about, yeah.
So let's rewind to the beginning of this crisis. So starting back in 2007, from 2007 to today, if we look at government debt-to-GDP across the eurozone, Italy's, is it higher or lower than at the start of this?
Italy's is higher.
Higher.
They're all higher.
They're basically all higher, so we can make that a short conversation. So everybody's got much, much higher debt to GDP, and with some of them really being quite staggering numbers. I mean, Greece is well over, what is it, 170%? It's something
like that. Yeah, something like that, yes.
It's astonishing.
But of course, that's the other thing, Chris. that is officially.
Officially. Unofficially?
Well, unofficially, I mean, pick a number. I mean, but I can tell you that it's well in excess of 170.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. So what happens with Italy now, though, if they voted for austerity, certainly it sent some rumblings across the market, which got papered over almost instantly, you know, one day later. So it was a 24-hour ripple in the markets. But it seems to me it should be more serious than that, because the exposure of banks to Italian debt, it's not like this is just like a little bit bigger than Greece. Italy just is an order of magnitude different from Greece in terms of the exposure of foreign banks to Italian debt. There's really, failure's not an option here, is it?
No, you're absolutely right. I think the question really is, how are they going to fund themselves from here? I mean, I think we abandon any thoughts that they're ever going to deal with their debts properly. It's a question of keeping the show on the road. And the two ways in which they can do this are either to persuade the Germans and the other sort of stronger northern countries to come up with the money, or the ECB. Now, the problem is that the Germans, I think, are going to backpedal, because they've got elections coming up in September, and so far Angela Merkel has been, she's had the fortune, if you like, to have an economy with a relatively low level of unemployment, which is, of course, the thing that really matters in European politics. Germany's unemployment has been running around about 5%, which is about half the average. So long as that persists, then there's generally a sort of general satisfaction, or at least no dissatisfaction, with the political masters, or mistresses in this case. But as soon as unemployment rises, then you'll find that people start sort of thinking, well, you know, this is a failure, this is no good, you know, we want something else. And the reason this is important is because the dynamic markets to which Germany exports are not her European neighbors. I mean, that's just stagnant and a waste of time as far as she's concerned. It's really China, Russia, Brazil, all those places. If you imagine these newly rich countries buying Mercedes and BMWs, but also German machinery and machine goods and tools and so on, that's really where her dynamic export markets have been. And of course, they're slowing down a bit. So between now and September, it's quite likely that the unemployment situation in Germany might deteriorate a little bit, assuming even the stability around her in the Eurozone. So this is going to discourage Angela Merkel, I think, from actually writing any checks. Now, the mechanism by which the countries do this is the European Stability Mechanism, which is a huge great fund, of which Germany is the main contributor, or the largest contributor. But guess what? The other big contributors are people like France, Italy, and Spain. So, we've got this ridiculous situation that out of the big boys in the fund, most of them are bust apart from Germany. So Germany is rather on her own here, and I think it gives her the opportunity to say, well, you know, thanks but no thanks, because there's not much point in us putting up money if Italy can't match it. So there is this sort of extraordinary impasse, if I can put it that way, I think, potentially, which will give Angela Merkel the excuse to pass the buck over to the ECB. Now, the Bundesbank don't like that, which is instinctively they don't like inflation. Instinctively they want to protect their savers. But really, I think there is no alternative, no practical alternative to the ECB funding the problems in the periphery countries. And that essentially is done by bank support, by QE, by whatever they can do to get away with it. And I think the principle has been established when Mario Draghi stood up, 3 months ago and said, we will do what it takes.
Well, Alistair, then, if the ECB receives the ball and they're going to do what Mario has promised, which is whatever it takes, that's obviously just code speak for printing. You mentioned some of the mechanisms by which they do that. Of course, there's been a lot of talk lately about currency wars. Wouldn't a weaker euro really serve a lot of purposes, both political and structural, over there at this point in time?
This is certainly the opinion, say, of the French finance minister. I mean, they, being statist Keynesian types, they buy into a weak currency to try and correct the too high labor costs rather than address too high labor costs. So that has certainly got attractions for a number of these countries. And yes, I mean, I think they would support that. I think Germany has a problem with that because she is more of a savings-driven economy, and in that category, I would also include Austria and possibly Holland as well. So I think this is the other feature we will probably see over 2013, but I don't think it's going to come to an awful lot, and that is there will be increasing agitation for Germany and Holland, you know, with whoever else wants to join, to set up their own currency block as an alternative. I mean, you hear various rumours about it, and I know there are some quite serious economists in Germany who want to pursue that route. So that's another thing maybe to watch out for, you know, the hope of there's an escape, if you like, by doing that. And I think one of the attractions of going that route is that you can cast off France and the rest of them into a weaker euro and let them run their own affairs, as it were, with ECB, rather than be tied into, you know, almost certainly an increasingly inflationary outlook.
Are there any rumblings that there's going to be such a schism at this point?
Well, there were rumblings last year. We're not hearing anything about it now. But mm-hmm. I did interview a German economist from Berlin who's very keen to do this. And he's quite a serious and senior guy. And, you know, he's got a name for it, the Gildenmark, already. You know, I mean, there are people talking about this. But I don't think it's getting any traction at the moment for the very simple reason that the political priority is to keep the Eurozone together. They want to keep this grand plan on the go. And so long as that's the case, no politician is going to sanction the idea of any alternative to the euro.
Well, what happens if Europe doesn't return to growth relatively soon? My understanding of most of these rescue packages were that they had very, I thought, generous, if not foolish, assumptions of growth baked into them. I saw, you know, Greece's rescue plan included a rapid return to 3, 4, 5, even 6% GDP growth starting this year. Things like that, and that hasn't happened. Are there any rumblings over there that are starting to consider what happens if growth doesn't return and why it might be that growth hasn't returned yet?
That is, I think, the big question. The Keynesians don't understand why growth isn't there. They're very, very disappointed. And, of course, their response is, well, the trouble is it's austerity, and, you know, you've got to stimulate the economy more. But the fact of the matter is that the average government size in the economy in the Eurozone is 50%. So 50% of every transaction is government. Now, that only leaves a private sector of 50%. So the private sector, when it comes to recovering, is carrying a huge great burden on its back.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in carrying that burden, the burden is trying to tax, if you like, the private sector horse is carrying it. And, you know, the tax burden is just so great and so great. And the way in which they're doing it in most of these countries is they're trying to preserve the public sector and they're trying to get the private sector to pay for it. And the result is that there is no way there's going to be any growth at all. And if you look at countries like Spain, for example, which has just, you know, sort of come out of the most massive property bubble. I mean, that's been really the reason for its downfall. The property bubble has not unwound at all. You've got huge, great levels of malinvestment, misdirection of funds in the wrong direction. The market has changed. People don't want it anymore. And the market's got to adapt. And you cannot expect that to happen, you know, until it's happened. And taxes are not going to be forthcoming until it's happened. And unfortunately, governments have got themselves stuck into this position where they're not prepared to cut their spending enough. They think they can get taxes, you know, like tax the rich or ratchet up the taxes on anyone who you think has got any money. But, you know, and then people avoid it. And they, you know, like in France, they just go abroad. It is that bad. So we're not seeing any recovery. The burden on the private sector is far too great for that recovery to occur. And not only that, but the economies in the Eurozone are angled completely towards the wrong production. And it's just a huge great burden of malinvestment that needs to be addressed. So you're not going to get any meaningful economic recovery without that slump, if you like, happening. And given that a slump happens, you've broadly got a choice. Either you let it get it over and done with and do it quickly, or you have financial repression in the hope that over a long period of time, something will turn up. And really, they're going for the latter rather than the former. But I don't think they've got that much time, because one of the things which Europe really does have a problem with is pension costs and mm-hmm. The cost of healthcare for the elderly and all the rest of it. You think it's expensive in America, it's twice as expensive in Europe on average.
Twice as expensive on what basis?
Well, on the basis, if you look at the number of, or the percentage, if you like, of the population who are pensioners as a percentage of the working population. In Europe, you're looking at figures 27-33%, that sort of figure. In the US, it's about 21%. I'm speaking from memory. But also the level of unemployment in Europe, the average is about 11% in the Eurozone. In America, your unemployment is about nearly 8%. In some countries, like Greece and Spain, I mean, particularly Spain, the level of unemployment is just absolutely horrendous. I mean, you're looking sort of 20%, 25%. So what this means is that you don't have the people working to pay the taxes to pay for these escalating pension costs. And the reason this is important is your readers will be aware of some work that Professor Kotlikoff did at Boston University.
Right.
He worked out that the net present value of future welfare costs and other off-balance sheet stuff in the year 2012 was an extra $11 trillion on the U.S. economy, which is, what, $15 trillion. We're talking about huge, great welfare costs coming down in the lift, which is going to swamp absolutely everything. Now, if it's that bad in America, and you just look at the dynamics of the situation in Europe, and conclude roughly it's twice as bad in Europe, then you can see that there is not enough time to hang around and wait for the private sector to recover under financial repression. I mean, you know, there just isn't the time. And this is the big problem that nobody seems to be focusing on. It's, you know, it's you either deal with this quickly and then start dealing with that problem, or you've had it. And that's roughly where they are in Europe.
Sounds like it's the same as in America, where we have deer in the headlights when you get into the big stuff like the pension underfundings and entitlement program shortfalls. And that $11 trillion you were talking about, that's an accrual-based deficit that the United States racked up in 2012, according to Kotlikoff. Even the Treasury said it was $6.5 trillion. Officially, we reported a cash basis shortfall of about $1.2 trillion. But it really, we're racking up these very large things that are compounding. Every week, month that passes, these things just get larger and larger and larger. Now, you've raised a very interesting concept for me, and I'm wondering what the similarity might be in Europe to this. I get the sense here in the United States that we have the underclasses, middle, which is really what formerly used to be called middle class, contributing almost nothing to the equation at this point in time. And you have large corporations, which have figured out through clever lawyering how to dodge, you know, paying effective tax rates that are above 20%, it seems. The squeeze is on what they're calling the rich, but really it's middle America. This is our productive class. So really the productive class, small and medium businesses, people who've got a real strong entrepreneurial spirit, who've worked hard, that seems to be where most of the targeting has fallen. When I parse through the details of the Affordable Health Care Act, also called Obamacare, but in some circles, you know, when I look at all of the things that have come through, they're really targeting the productive class. And that seems just grossly counterproductive to me. It might work on the short term, but long term, I'm wondering if Europe perhaps has sort of a peek into the future for that for us. And I don't know.
Well, I'm afraid that the story in Europe is exactly the same as you've described it, Chris. I mean, we're trying to pursue the wealthy. We're clamping down on taxes. You know, in Italy, they literally impound your yacht, you know, and then you have to argue about it later, sort of thing. I mean, it really is. It really is. As you say, as you put it so well, it is taxing. It is removing wealth from the productive classes. And when you do that, well, what the productive classes do is they stop bothering about trying to make money making things, and they start bothering about how to make money by keeping it away from the taxman. It's a complete diversion of resources into something that is useless as far as the state is concerned. But, you know, over in Europe, there is this sort of belief, I suppose, that, you know, if someone's richer than me, then he should, you know, he should contribute more in taxes. And I know that your politicians are sort of playing that sort of game, but over here, it's been like this forever. And, you know, I'm sure we'll come on to the UK in a moment, but, you know, this is one of the problems that the Chancellor, George Osborne, has, and that is he's in coalition with a very sort of, I suppose, you know, left-wing party, and left-wing in the sense that they're desperate to redistribute wealth from the rich to the poor. And, of course, in the process, you just destroy the productive capacity of the economy. And that's the story all around Europe. And, you know, I can see it's in America as well. And that's why there's going to be
let's finish our tour through Southern Europe first before we move to the UK. Spain. Let's finish up on Spain here. Obviously, Spain is still, in my view, looking like they're in relatively poor shape. They have extraordinary, and last I checked, rising levels of defaults on the outstanding book of balance at the banks. So it looked to me like things are not at all improved there. What's going on in Spain right now?
Well, Spain, I mean, you're right. I think it goes back to the election, which was a bit over a year ago, about 18 months ago, when Rajoy was elected. He got in with a clear working majority, which gave him the opportunity to tackle Spain's problems, and he didn't. He sort of went at it half-heartedly, and that was the opportunity missed. And on top of that, the root of Spain's problems, apart from, really goes back to credit expansion, which fueled property prices.
Right.
It's very similar to the United States. The fueling of the property prices was even greater than you saw in the United States. But so far, the correction in house prices has not been as great as in the United States, which rather suggests that house prices have even got further to fall. Now, on top of that, the mortgage bank system, the Cajas, C-A-J-A, basically, they were sort of run, I think, dare I say, almost slightly as sort of slush funds for vested interests like unions and all the rest of it. And they were unregulated, and I think they still are unregulated. And, of course, all the losses appeared in these mortgage banks. They have consolidated the seven of the biggest ones into Bankia, which is a new entity. And already they've had to produce about 40 billion euros to stop that one going under. All the original depositors who were forced to accept shares in return for their deposits have now lost all their money. And the banking system, really, mostly through this mortgage lending and also lending to construction companies, looks like is going to require a total of about 100 billion euros. Now, that's been sort of agreed to be provided by the finance ministers in the eurozone, but we don't know how that's going to happen. So far, I think I'm right in saying about 40 billion has actually been provided via the ESF fund. Now, I think Germany is going to dig her heels in on this one, or could well do, in which case it's going to be rescue the banks through the ECB. And so the ECB will throw money at the Spanish banking system to keep it afloat. And so what's new? Spain is a tragedy because if they'd taken action early, they would only have had the property bubble and the construction industry to deal with. As it is, what they've done is by mishandling it, they're effectively sinking the whole economy, and I think it's an absolute tragedy. You've got over 50% unemployment amongst the under-25s, which is a complete lost generation. You are, I think, as a result, and also as 25% unemployment more broadly, I think you're going to have a strong possibility of social unrest in 2013, and Spain is still bad news. I was talking to an economist, I was interviewing an economist the other day, and he was thinking that Spain actually would be the first one to create the next crisis in the eurozone. He thought that Spain was ahead of Italy and France in this, but that was before the Italian election.
Okay. Well, so Spain is clearly sailing, you know, in pretty close to the wind here. They've got very, very high debt levels. Their industry, such as it is, they were really living through a bubble, and they failed to just address that first while the bubble was going.
Can I just add something? I mean, what's interesting in this is that unlike Italy and France, who, particularly Italy, has always had very high levels of debt to GDP, Spain started in the banking crisis with a debt to GDP of only 40%.
Really? 40%?
Yeah. And now she's, this year, she's about 100 now. So it just shows you how rapidly a situation can deteriorate.
Well, speaking of rapidly deteriorating situations, what are you seeing in Greece? I know we've all been reading the reports, which almost have that sort of Fukushima effect where we're reading less and less of it, even though the stories are more and more dire. I think over here, at least, because I think the story's old or something, perhaps it's lost some interest in the media cycle. But when I bothered to find out what's going on there, I hear about just rampant unemployment, hunger even, people chopping down trees to stay warm, all the usual things that you would see in a full-blown economic collapse. Is that view wide of the mark? Has that been exaggerated? What do you see?
No, the view is absolutely right. I mean, Greece has disappeared from the headlines, partly because Europe, until now, has disappeared from the headlines, and also partly because Greece is pretty small beer compared with what's coming up in the lift.
And so where does Greece go from here? I know that at one point it was thought they were going to be the trigger for the next round of the crisis because they wouldn't be able to meet some debt payment or other. Are they okay financially for the moment?
I would hesitate to describe them as okay financially. I mean, basically, they're very badly wounded and they're struggling on. Germany, I think, has provided the bulk of the funds to keep her going so far, which, of course, creates quite a bit of resentment. But Germany doesn't want to provide very much more, I don't think, and this is the problem. So the Greeks are now in the position where they're having to deal with their own problems themselves. I haven't read reports of them funding in the market recently. I think that they're probably being helped by the ECB to try and... I mean, the ECB will help anyone, because their problem is they don't want the banking system to fall over. And if you get bankruptcies in the Greek banking system, there's no knowing how far that will spread. So I think the answer to your question, Chris, is that Germany has helped them so far, but I guess that the ECB will be in there at the moment, sort of taking care of their short-term needs, if I can put it that way.
Well, fantastic. So we're rolling over the short-term needs, applying Band-Aids where necessary, sticking fingers in the dikes. What will it take to turn this around? It's got to be strong economic growth, doesn't it?
That's the only thing, and, as we've already discussed, with an average of 50% government spending to GDP, there isn't an awful lot of private sector, and particularly free private sector, to grow these countries way out of trouble. I mean, I just can't see it happening, unfortunately. So, now that Germany is sort of, effectively backing off, that's not the official line, and it's now down to the ECB, I think the inevitable outcome is at some stage this will turn into hyperinflation.
Wow.
I don't see any alternative. I mean, having said that, I don't see things very different in most other jurisdictions.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, look at Japan. They've now effectively run out of domestic savings, so they're printing. There's only one way that's going to go. America, same sort of thing. When I look at the sort of monthly contribution from the Fed into the economy is running at something like $85 billion a month. When I look at the pace at which money supply has been growing in the States, it seems to me that that's not enough. Now, that's a horrendous statement to make, but, if they don't accelerate the rate at which they're printing money in the States, then I think interest rates are bound to rise sooner than they would otherwise. Either that, or you're going to start getting some financial failures. Probably both. I don't know. So, once you get onto this debt trap and the requirement to print money to keep government afloat, to keep the banks afloat, you cannot get off the cycle. And I think that's what we've got in America. We've got all around Europe. We've got it in the UK, which is, I'm sure we'll come on to in a moment. And you've definitely got it in Japan.
It's always the Fed was thought to be fearing what was called the liquidity trap. But in fact, I think you just articulated the real trap, which is that once you're printing to keep your government afloat, that's pretty much you're in phase one of game over. Phase two is when the interest rates start to rise. Of course, we all know you can just run calculations with a crayon and napkin and discover that even such a slight rise in interest rates, just maybe putting them back at their historical averages, would really crush the fiscal situations of entire nation states at this point, let alone companies and individuals and all of that. We've gotten ourselves in a position where we can't survive higher interest rates. So what do you do about that? How do you walk down your debt if you can't get your economies growing, so your debts just keep growing? Alistair, how do you get out of this?
Well, I think that there is only one logical conclusion, and that is a complete default. And you've got two ways in which you can default. One is to accept reality and face that, or the other way is to try and kick the can down the road, which just involves accelerating the printing. Now, you can print money to quite a degree until such time as your citizens decide that, my goodness, this stuff, this dollar or the euro or whatever it is, I don't want it anymore. I would rather have goods. Now, at that stage, you get a flight out of money into goods. doesn't do your production any good, by the way. But what it basically means is that the shelves get cleared out, prices rise very sharply, and then you're on a slippery slope because the only thing backing a paper currency is confidence in it. Forget all this stuff about the quantity theory of money. It doesn't apply. If you lose confidence in a paper currency, it can become valueless very, very quickly. I think if you look back at the best documented inflation, the German one in 1922-23, I think the true hyperinflation was probably only about 5 or 6 months. Until that time, of course, the mark had lost well over 99.9% of its value, certainly from the pre-war time. But it was only in that last phase that people suddenly, they woke up to the fact that the one thing they did not want to have was paper money. They lost all hope that this inflation would stop. And at that point, the function of how long it lasts, the hyperinflation lasts, becomes one of the practical problem of how you deal with it. And in the case of Germany, they had to go to, they had to write a check, they had to draw the money out of the bank. The bank probably had to wait, because nobody would take checks, I mean, they would only take cash. The bank had to wait for deliveries of cash. The printing presses were running 24 hours a day to supply the demand. So that took 5 months. Now we have credit cards. We have electronic settlements. So how long is it going to take for a paper currency collapse? I mean, it could be minutes. It could be a day. I do remember, you mentioned Iceland earlier. I do remember that when the Icelandic crisis hit, I was following the price of the krona on the day all this happened, and at one point it had lost 70% of its value in a morning. It recovered, it clawed back some of that by the end of the day. But that's what can happen. It can happen very, very quickly. So really, pursuing this, sort of funding our way out of the problem by printing yet more money, it can actually bite back on you, and the game can finish without very much notice very, very quickly. It's not a game where you're going to have time to exit. It really isn't.
I've thought that for a long time as well. I'm also noting that a hyperinflation really only takes on meaning when there's a border to cross, meaning that you can compare that currency to something. So with Japan printing like crazy, the European Central Bank printing, the Federal Reserve printing, with all of these characters printing, which border do you compare yourself against? And of course, for myself, that's always been gold, and gold has just been languishing for a long time. Do you have any, what are you seeing from your perspective over there around gold?
Well, it's interesting because, going back to my hypothesis about hyperinflation, when people sort of, it occurs when people lose all hope about their paper money, we have a situation now where currency in the form of paper money is the only form of exchange in the markets. True money, as you and I know, throughout history has always been gold. People are not yet thinking that gold is something that they need to have to defend themselves in a paper currency collapse, because they don't see the paper currency collapse. They really don't. And there will come a time, I think, when that is going to switch, and it'll probably switch quite sharply. But meanwhile, what's been happening is that we've had the deterioration in the European situation. We've had the deterioration in the American statistics. We've got a deterioration in our own here. And Japan, as I said earlier, has run out of savers. I mean, someone came up with a wonderful statistic that in Japan, they sell more diapers to the aged than they do to children now. I mean, that's not the position you want to get into. And, they are on the slippery slope of destroying their own paper monies, destroying confidence in it. Gold, meanwhile, has just walked sideways. It's done nothing. It has been controlled as much as anything by the bullion banks, who have expanded the amount of paper gold and paper silver in circulation to deflate the speculative demand in it. Meanwhile, the true demand from people who are insuring themselves against systemic risk is there, and people have just been squirreling it away very, very quietly. In some countries, they do this. In India, for example, they've been doing this for decades. China have just started doing it. I see that continuing and building. Russia is sending very, very clear signals that it doesn't want to have anything to do with Western paper currencies, with the central bank there being quite aggressive building up her gold holdings. So all the signs are that the situation is deteriorating. We see that the gold price has been sat on, and it's only a matter of time, I think, before it can no longer be controlled. But the trouble is that when that happens, there are going to be some very major banks in quite serious difficulties because of all the short positions.
Well, they almost got in severe trouble all the way back, I believe it was 1998 or 1999. It was when your own illustrious exchequer decided to openly announce a reverse Dutch auction and dishoard UK's gold at bargain basement prices. That was largely, I believe, to protect some bullion banks that had gotten into a very, very large amount of trouble because they'd been doing leasing of gold and just simply didn't have it.
I think, you're right. I mean, there have been these few times in history where having kept the price of bullion down below where it would naturally be, a demand from elsewhere has just taken it away. It's a process that went all the way through, certainly the second half of the 80s and through the 90s. It was at that time, I think, that the Middle East started building up their reserves. India has always had a huge demand for gold, but it's only relatively recently, I think about 10 years, 10 maybe a bit more years, that officially people have been able to import gold rather than smuggle it in. But, I mean, I remember going to what used to be called Bombay back in the late 60s, and I ran a very interesting exercise recently on this. I looked up the price of gold in rupees at the time, and you could buy the sort of fabricated gold that Indians buy as their store of wealth, you know, the sort of fairly plain jewelry for their wives, that sort of thing. And it would cost you all in less than 200 rupees an ounce. Given that the tradition in India is to save into gold and silver, you know, when children are born, you buy some more, you know, for the child. You know, if a son gets married or daughter gets married, you've got the dowry, you know, you give them some gold jewelry to start with. The whole of the sort of the middle classes in India, if I can put it that way, revolve their savings round gold. Now, it's gone from less than 200 rupees when I was there in 1968, I think it was. Do you know what the price is now? It's about 100,000 rupees.
100,000?
So who's been the clever guy? You know, I mean, there is nothing else that the Indian could have put his money in order to preserve his wealth, which has been so effective. And he's not about to change his habits, I can assure you. They know what happens to paper currencies. They know what happens to the rupee. And, you know, the average Chinese guy, I think, has got exactly the same approach towards his own currency.
Well, I imagine that in dollar terms, gold's been going sideways, but if we turn our attention to your home country in the UK with the pound falling so much, I know there's been a lot of calls for austerity as being the culprit in this case, so the calls are to end austerity. How is gold being viewed in the UK right now? And then secondarily, what is going on over there economically right now?
Well, okay, the gold question first. I think that the view here on gold is probably quite similar to the view in America. Complete disinterest. I mean, really, it is complete disinterest. And, you know, people see the price sort of over the last 10, 12 years has risen quite sharply, and they say, well, of course, it's in a bubble. But, of course, you know, a bubble only occurs when everybody's got it. Nobody has got it. They really haven't. So, you know, I'm a gold bug, and I'm in a tiny minority. I really am. I think if you ask 1,000 people in the street, would you buy gold as an investment? You probably find one might say yes. It is literally like that. And I guess it's probably the same with you in America. I mean, I don't know whether I'm right, but I just get the feeling there is complete disinterest in the subject.
Oh, absolutely there is. We have none of the social hallmarks of a bubble. We only have prices that seem to have gone up a bit. And my view on that is that those prices had to rise because otherwise, if they hadn't, can you imagine how much gold India would be buying today if it was $280 an ounce like it hit way back in 1999? It's just, it would be ridiculous.
Absolutely.
The prices.
I think the other way to look at it, Chris, is that actually it's not gold that's gone up. It is the quantity of dollars, the quantity of pounds, the quantity of euros, whatever it is, that has increased so much that it actually buys less gold.
And oil. and wheat.
And oil, and exactly, and all those other things.
Absolutely. So let's turn now to the economics. I've been reading about, of course, renewed recessionary fears over there in the UK, and the foreign indebtedness of the UK is actually quite extraordinary. There's some really pressing issues there, aren't there?
Well, yes. Well, first of all, the economy. Last year, they managed to just about sort of, I suppose, do slightly better than break even. So we weren't quite in recession. I think that all that sort of stuff is pretty meaningless anyway. But we have a budget, and the budget in the UK is a major political and economic event. It's the one time when the Chancellor stands up in the House and he arranges the taxes and he gives his forecasts and all the rest of it. And all the commentators get all terribly excited and so on. So that is on March the 20th. Now, unfortunately, we had Moody's S&P came out with a ratings downgrade earlier this week. And, of course, that's been dismissed as well. We knew it was coming, so it really doesn't matter. This is not news. But when you bear in mind that sterling has fallen from literally the 1st of January to now, from about 162 down to current level of 151 and a bit, and in the process it has broken some very important support levels that we've seen hold over the last 2 years, we have, I think, potentially the makings of a sterling crisis. Now, the reason that this is important is our economy actually isn't going anywhere. The Chancellor's numbers when it comes to stand up on March the 20th, I don't think can in any way impress the market. There isn't going to be any sort of sudden magic elixir, as it were. On top of that, we've had, with sterling falling, an aggravation, and that is the price of petrol, or gas, as your guys would call it over there, has risen from around about 122 pence a litre to today it's just under 150 pence per litre.
Ouch.
And that's literally over the last 2 months. We have had this, I don't know if you've heard, but we had this horse meat scandal whereby the food chain has got so complex that nobody can keep track of it. And the result is that horse meat has been found in beef burgers. And the effect of this scare has been to push people into, if you like, better quality meat. And so the result is that meat prices here are rising quite sharply. So instead of having a background of inflation that might be slightly above target, which is what the Bank of England has been forecasting, we're now looking at a situation where inflation is likely to be considerably above target. Now, the trouble is that there is nothing really that the Bank of England can do about it that it would be comfortable doing. Like, what it should do when you've got the potential of a sterling crisis is to raise interest rates to take all the expectation out of the market. But we're funding a government deficit. We have a fragile banking system, which I don't think would survive rising interest rates. So quite naturally, the Bank of England is likely to sort of try and wish this problem away. And indeed, we saw a guy called Paul Tucker, who's a deputy governor, before the Commons Treasury Select Committee last night, saying that the Bank of England was thinking of charging negative interest rates on balances held with it.
I just read that.
This doesn't affect ordinary depositors, but it does affect the banks, the commercial banks who have accounts with the Bank of England. It's rather like turning the Fed turning round on its excess reserves and saying to the banks, we're going to charge you if you're going to leave the money here. They want to try and push it out into the economy. But I do feel that if, you know, this idea of, having almost zero interest rates and negative interest rates for a bank is likely to accelerate a sterling crisis rather than retard it. So we do have the potential for a sterling crisis. And unfortunately, what happens with a sterling crisis is that interest rates end up rising until such point as the corrective action is taken. And that corrective action is extremely painful. So we're in the situation here in Europe, I think, where we've all been looking at what's going on in Europe and thinking, oh my God, they've got themselves into a mess. But actually, the mess may well be triggered by the UK. So the sterling situation, I think, does need to be watched very, very carefully.
Interesting. So let's talk about timing then. This is all dragged on far longer than I thought possible. I think there's been a masterful display of printing, obfuscation, propagandizing, jawboning, you name it. It's just been golf clap. It's been very nice. How much longer can this all continue, do you think?
Well, As you so rightly say, these things always drag out longer than you think possible. I do feel, however, that we're very much on the last lap on this one, and I think 2013 is going to be very much the year when lots and lots of chickens come home to roost. And whether they start coming home to roost in the next 2 or 3 months or whether it's the next 6 months, I don't know. But, you know, the situation, the backstop situation in the sense that, you know, the pension problem and all the rest of it, that's not in the headlines at the moment, but there's no doubt about it that is going to become a huge issue. And I think it will become an issue later on this year. We're now in the situation where anyone lending money to Spain or Italy or France is going to start thinking, well, hold on a minute. You know, I know they've got a short-term problem, and I know the economy isn't going very well, etc. But am I not right in thinking that demographics and pensions and all the rest of it are going to be going to mean that this country is going to go bust very quickly anyway? In other words, I think the markets will start considering these things, and at some stage, the markets are going to take control of interest rates, the pricing of money, away from the central banks. I do feel that point is not very far away, but as you rightly point out, you know, very often I call recessions and they never happen, so it's a difficult one. But I do think 2013 is going to be the year when we do really see a sharp deterioration in the overall position.
Well, if that happens, I'm believing that it's going to be rather disappointing for a lot of folks, largely because, you know, this will be the third iteration of this crisis. We've already been through a couple of passes of it. And with every one of those, there's been, you know, people have invested hope that the authorities know what they're doing, that they have a plan, that this will all resolve itself somehow. That, you know, I'm mystified that so many people are not, in the investment side in particular, are not looking at this and saying, look, we've tried this several times. We've printed trillions of dollars. Arguably, we've prevented something worse from happening, but we've also not been able to achieve anything that would really look like a sustainable liftoff. And by the way, just editorially, I can't find any records of oil being well over $110 a barrel on the world stage and having any sort of economic recovery. There's just a problem inherent in that. But where do, you know, just, it feels to me like there ought to be some sort of reckoning moment that comes with this. And I think this next crisis is going to be so much harder to pick ourselves up from because so much political capital will have been expended, so much hope capital will have been expended, real capital. There won't be a whole lot left to spend. And really then at that point, we have to get back to what you said before is you have to face the music. Are you going to default by overt default, we're just gonna eliminate a whole lot of these debts, or is it gonna be covert? Are we really going to get serious about the printing and really let the world know? Which I think is what Japan is doing. Japan is saying, we don't care, we're going to really print this and make a substantial difference in our inflationary outcomes and the value of the yen, period. It's gonna get done. It feels to me like that the pressures are building for some sort of a resolution to this. Either we go off the knife edge to the left and it's inflationary, if not hyperinflationary, or we go off to the right and it's deflationary. But one way or the other, it's been a bit long skating along this knife edge without a lot to show for it, honestly.
Yeah, no, I agree with you entirely. I would like to make one observation, though, about market psychology. And that is, in a bull market, we look forward to things. We anticipate things. We look at a company and we say, I think that company's, you know, new product means that its sales are going to be da-da-da. So, you know, the good things in a bull market get discounted ahead of time. In a bear market, it works the reverse way. Prices, basically, most of the time, are made by people who live in hope. And even though you and I, as Cassandras, might look and say, oh, my goodness, we don't like the world, look at this or that or whatever, the market sails on regardless. But then there comes a point where reality intervenes. So when it happens, it can happen very, very suddenly. But of course, we cannot predict the exact moment that's going to happen. But I think there is that difference between bull market and bear market psychology, and I think we need to keep that in mind.
That's a fair point. I like it a lot. I love everything I've heard so far. And that's all the time we have today. So, Alistair, I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for another fascinating interview and discussion about what's going on in Europe. And I hope we can do this again sometime soon.
I look forward to it. And it's very nice speaking to you again, Chris.